The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, it's part three of our coverage of the 69th session of the UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs. But first, the Kino Border Initiative and the Washington Office on Latin America have released a report entitled Denouncing Into the Void, the Dismantling of Internal Oversight and Accountability at DHS. They launched that report at a webinar on March 19th. Let's hear one of the speakers. Here's Adam Isaacson, Director for Defense Oversight at the Washington Office on Latin America.
Before I start, I should just mention that the report itself can be found at the short link using the bit.ly service, bit.ly. Do a slash after that and just type the words void report, and that will take you straight to the text of the report. So, yeah, I mean, this is all happening at a time when DHS has vastly increased its capacity to arrest people, often quite aggressively. It has just about, not quite, but just about doubled its detention capacity, and just about, but not quite, it's about 50 or 60% more than usual, increased its deportation capacity. And of course, anybody who reads the headlines over the last several months knows this, but that's the context in which the capacity to do effective oversight from within and to try to impact the organizational culture at DHS from within has been decimated. Now, yeah, Michelle very well described these agencies. I would add that they are all, their existence in all cases is mandated by law. They're in permanent law. They're in the U.S. code. They just can't be abolished because the president says so. What happened a year ago this Saturday is that the Trump administration, they decided something that was sort of foreseen in the Project 2025 document. They decided that they would reduce these offices to their most minimal statutory expression. People who worked for CRCL and OIDO and CSOM got a notice on March 21st of last year saying that they were all to be subject to a reduction in force, fired by the middle of May. Now, as a result of that, I mean, there was firings, there's been some hirings of contractors, but today CRCL is 80% smaller than it was a year ago. Only about 30 people working where there had been about 145. And most of those people are contractors. OIDO is 96% smaller, even as the detained population has nearly doubled. Now, elsewhere in DHS for oversight, there's still an inspector general's office, which has been quite troubled. And in fact, the inspector general, who himself was a Trump appointee, recently sent a memo to Congress saying that he is not getting the cooperation he needs and he's being stonewalled. And then there are offices of protection, professional responsibility at CBP and ICE, which are small, although they did grow somewhat in recent years. So the firings really badly weakened an oversight and accountability system that was already very far from strong enough. OIDO, for instance, now has 5 employees to oversee a system of about 220 detention centers in ICE's network. You put all of those together before last March 21st, you had a ratio of about 1 oversight employee for every 126 DHS staff. The New York Police Department is about half that as far as internal affairs. They have more coverage of oversight than DHS does, and now that has been badly weakened. These offices could make recommendations. They couldn't necessarily enforce compliance with the recommendations, which was a problem. As the Kino Border Initiative can tell you, transparency about what happened after complaints was sometimes an issue. That said, these offices did play a very important role, even though they often were circumscribed. They had very dedicated, committed staff who were badly mistreated a year ago and were really feeling their absence now. They would be able to review or stop or at least slow down new policies that got introduced that might violate civil rights, privacy, or human rights. They were able to carry out inspections of detention facilities, including unannounced. Sometimes just the mere threat that there might be a complaint investigation was enough to deter abuse or influence behavior at ICE and CBP. Even if the investigation didn't result in discipline or ruin your career, it would still be a lot of red tape, and perhaps some reputational harm. So that was a disincentive. And also just having people with deep knowledge of civil rights, civil liberties, which is sort of a squishy term that's not all that well defined always in U.S. law or understood, being at the table, being present in internal policy discussions. Former CRCL employees we talked to assured us that there was an impact on the overall institutional culture at DHS that maybe wasn't that visible to those of us on the outside or those of us wondering what was happening to the complaints that were filed, that even as we were documenting abuses at the border, many bad things perhaps were not happening because of the cultural influence that those officers had on the inside informally. But then, yeah, they were decimated March through May of last year. Work on complaints stopped for months. Nobody there to review them. 2 months after the firings, the deputy director of CRCL testified that he was still working on a plan as to how to keep the agencies going. CRCL has not issued any new recommendations. And as KBI can tell you, complaints resulted just in form emails and no feedback. New complaints can only be submitted on the web portal. No phone calls, no regular mail, no email, only in English. Other languages are no longer accepted. So if you're in detention and think bad things are happening to you, you better hope your detention center has a tablet you can use, time that the guards give you time to use it, that you can somehow use it in your non-native language of English. And yeah, OIDO complaints have collapsed as the report documents over the last year. Investigations are often halted now when an individual leaves ICE custody, which is an incentive to deport people quickly. And required reporting to Congress is very badly behind. This is all in the report. Now, you know, I don't need to read the past several months' headlines to you, but yeah, 13 people since January 3rd have died in ICE detention, which is a pace we've never seen before. We're getting constant reports of families being separated, including a new report this morning from Women's Refugee Commission and Physicians for Human Rights documenting this happening inside the United States. Use of force issues obviously are making headlines. And then you've got all these new technologies like facial recognition, license plate readers, drones, unification of databases that should not be unified, raising enormous privacy concerns with little sense that anything is now happening within DHS to slow it down. And meanwhile, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act from last July puts about $170 billion plus more into ICE and CBP between now and the end of the Trump administration, which will pretty much triple ICE's enforcement and removal operations staff through a very rushed hiring process, adding 3,000 more Border Patrol agents with, again, there was no money in that bill for more oversight or accountability capacity. And the bill that the U.S. Congress has still not agreed on, this is not one of the controversial parts, but what was in that bill, it should be controversial, I think, but it's not part of the argument. The draft bill would actually cut CRCL's budget from about $43 million a year to $10 billion a year, million a year, sorry, and zeroes out OIDO completely. So there is a lot to be done here to recover from this once there is an opportunity to do so.
That was Adam Isaacson, Director for Defense Oversight at WOLA, speaking at the launch of the new report, Denouncing Into the Void, the Dismantling of Internal Oversight and Accountability at DHS. Another speaker at that event was Juan Cuellar, Director of Education and Advocacy at the Kino Border Initiative.
Well, in the report, we document a steep collapse in accountability. Under previous administrations, to give an example, some of our complaints were investigated. But in the past year, none of the 21 complaints that we have filed led to a formal investigation. And nearly half of these complaints from the past year were closed outright. Like after months of silence, we received generic emails informing us that the complaint had been received and that the case was being closed, which was quite surprising considering that some of the cases that we were filing merited some sort of investigation. At the same time, our interviews show that abuses are widespread. So 4 out of 5 recently deported people report to us that some sort of abuse during their arrest or detention happened to them. And many migrants now tell us that they are either fearful of retaliation, so they are not willing to file a complaint, or they simply believe that nothing will change. In the report, we also share that our process of filing complaints tries to be as complete as possible. So we not only carry out the filing of the complaint online as is requested by these offices, but we go a step further and also send an email to CRCL, OIEDO, OPR, and OIG. And whenever possible, we seek local support from let's say the CBP Office of Professional Responsibility in Tucson to seek support in specific cases. When we seek for these local support help, we do see that officers there in this office, at least in Tucson, they are willing to help us. But these are just exceptions to the rule because the accountability system meant to support them also has been hollowed out. So as we have experienced it, the current complaint process is performative. It's just there, it exists, but it perpetrates impunity with its silence.
That was Juan Cuellar, Director of Education and Advocacy at the Kino Border Initiative, speaking at the launch of a new report from KBI and the Washington Office on Latin America entitled Denouncing Into the Void, the Dismantling of Internal Oversight and Accountability at DHS. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, the rest of today's show is part three of our coverage of the 69th session of the UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs, which was held March 9th through 13th in Vienna, Austria. First, from the morning of Thursday, March 12th, here's Ben Saul, Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism and Human Rights at the UN's Human Rights Council.
As the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Counterterrorism, I draw your attention to alarming developments in efforts to suppress narcotics in the Americas, which deeply undermines efforts to achieve Sustainable Development Goal 16. Organized criminal violence associated with drug trafficking and drug addiction are serious threats to the human right to life and to peaceful, sustainable development. States must take all feasible measures to address these threats. Regrettably, some American states have resorted to measures that themselves flagrantly violate fundamental rights. Since September 2025, the United States has unlawfully killed at least 151 people in military attacks on 45 civilian vessels on the high seas, allegedly to prevent so-called narco-terrorism. These serial extrajudicial killings gravely violate the right to life, should be denounced by all states, and the perpetrators must be held accountable. The United States' abusive designation of American drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations was also a pretext to launch illegal aggression against Venezuela, further violating the right to life and arbitrarily detaining its president. The U.S. has threatened illegal force also against Mexico and Colombia. The designations further enabled the illegal summary expulsion of hundreds of foreign nationals to El Salvador in violation of non-refoulement and the prohibition on arbitrary detention, enforced disappearance, and inhumane treatment. Other American countries have also listed organized crime groups as terrorists, including Canada, Ecuador, Argentina, Paraguay, and El Salvador, and there are proposals in Honduras and Brazil. This is not consistent with best practice international definitions of terrorism and organized crime. Terrorism should be limited to political violence and exclude profit-motivated organized crime as defined under the Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime. A further concern, as in Ecuador, is the declaration of armed conflict against organized crime groups, including shoot-to-kill powers, where the threshold of armed conflict is not met under international humanitarian law. Criminal justice protections have also been weakened and emergency powers adopted without adequate safeguards. Combating organized crime should focus on strengthening law enforcement and intelligence capacities and cooperation, not unlawful killings or abusive terrorist listings. Efforts must also be made to address root causes, including by supporting development in vulnerable communities, pursuing effective domestic drug prevention, education, and public health initiatives, and preventing U.S. military-grade weapons from flooding the region, arming cartels, and destabilizing other states. Respect for human rights, accountability, and the rule of law are the foundations of principled and effective action against organized crime and for ensuring peaceful, sustainable development in the region. Thank you.
That was Ben Saul, Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism and Human Rights at the UN's Human Rights Council, addressing the 69th session of the CND on Thursday, March 12th. Now here's Benjamin Phillips, co-founder of the International Drug Law Advocacy and Resource Center.
Mr. Chair, Excellencies, dear colleagues, I'm delivering this statement today on behalf of the International Drug Law Advocacy and Resource Centre, IDLOC, and in collaboration with DRC Net Foundation, who completely endorse this statement. This year marks 10 years since the UNGAS was held in New York. The UNGAS gave a very clear mandate for international interagency cooperation and coordination. We're also approaching the 80th anniversary of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, yet egregious human rights abuses continue to be committed in the name of drug control. There are member states here in this very room that are carrying out atrocities, including but not limited to extrajudicial killings, kidnapping and abductions, committing war crimes, including the bombing of civilian fishing boats, torture, the death penalty, cruel, inhumane and degrading punishment, police violence and other state-sponsored violence, racial discrimination and the racist profiling of people of color, gender-based discrimination and the impediment of access to essential medicines, as well as countless other egregious human rights violations. In October last year, the Human Rights Council passed HRC 60/26. This contains unprecedented support for and some of the strongest language to date on human rights, harm reduction, racial discrimination, and the rights of Indigenous peoples. It is crucial this language is incorporated into future C&D resolutions as implemented by member states on the ground. As civil society, we support the role of multi-agency task groups such as the UN System Coordination Task Team to consolidate system-wide coherence and improve interagency coordination. This and the UN System Common Position on Drugs will assist with, and I quote, the development implementation of policies that put people, health, and human rights at the center. Interagency cooperation and coordination is also crucial for ending AIDS and viral hepatitis by 2030. People who inject drugs are being left behind. The 2021 Political Declaration on HIV notes, and I quote, that the majority of countries and regions have not made significant progress in expanding harm reduction programs, and that is due to the application of restrictive laws that hampers access to HIV-related services. We express concern about the shrinking space for civil society. We call on UN agencies and member states to champion the inclusion of civil society, including academics and organizations run by people who use drugs. We are the ones most often working on the ground and bring real-world experience to the table. There is a very clear mandate for interagency cooperation, and it can be found in both the 2016 UNGAS outcome document and the UN Common Position on Drugs. As we approach the 80th anniversary of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, we call on member states and Vienna-based drug control entities to welcome and incorporate contributions from the Office of the High Commission on Human Rights and other UN entities into the drug control mechanisms here in Vienna. Thank you.
That was Benjamin Phillips, co-founder of the International Drug Law Advocacy and Resource Center, addressing the 69th session of the CND on the morning of Thursday, March 12th. Here's a representative of YouthRise.
Chair, distinguished delegates, I speak on behalf of YouthRise, an international network of young people who use drugs and young people affected by drug policies. We advocate for evidence-based, rights-centered approaches that prioritize young people's health and well-being while addressing the structural conditions that shape our vulnerability. Discussions about drugs almost always start from the same place. How do we protect young people? But there's another question we urgently need to ask. What does real protection look like in our lives? On the 9th of March, the Human Rights Council in Geneva observed the annual Day on the Rights of the Child, focusing on the human rights violation of children in armed conflicts. In many parts of the world, militarized efforts to curb organized crime and drug trafficking lead to armed clashes that place children and young people at greater risk of experiencing direct violence from both criminal groups and the law enforcement sent to dismantle them. Police raids profile and criminalize youth in low-income communities and feed into stigma and discrimination that have lifelong consequences. During these operations, young people cannot freely walk in the streets, go to school, or reach healthcare facilities, and these disruptions can last for days. Resolution 68/6, which established the independent expert panel, calls for the consultations with a broad range of stakeholders, including youth. As part of a project led by the Global Commission on Drug Policy, YouthRise conducted consultations with young people in diverse regions to understand how drug policies shape their lives, rights, and access to care. We are turning these findings into an evidence-based recommendations in a policy brief to be released in April. We grounded this work in international human rights frameworks, especially the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and ensured that children's and young people's perspectives guided the analysis and the recommendations. 10 years ago, the UNGAS carried the slogan, "A Better Tomorrow for Today's Youth." We asked member states, was that merely a slogan, or did it lead to meaningful action? Do the laws implemented since then reduce stigma and violence, or do they drive them? Real protection for children and young people cannot be measured by drug seizure numbers, but whether young people, including young people who use drugs, are safer, healthier, and freer. We urge member states to apply the principles of do no harm across all policies that concern youth, recognizing meaningful youth participation, harm reduction, and the protection of rights as non-negotiable standards. Thank you.
That was a representative of Youth Rise addressing the CND on the morning of March 12th. Now, here's a representative of the Africa Network of People Who Use Drugs.
Thank you so much, Chair. I speak on behalf of the African Network of People Who Use Drugs. And just to note that across Africa, drug policy remains rooted in colonial punitive frameworks that criminalize and marginalize our community. This drive for punishment fuels incarceration, poverty, stigma, and preventable deaths. Harm reduction is more than drug use autonomy. It is a movement grounded in human rights, bodily autonomy, and justice led by most affected. We draw solidarity and lessons from movement across Latin America, Asia, and the Global South. The community led from Colombia's COCA initiative to Senegal integrated opioid agonist treatment services and grassroots work in Africa that shows inclusion, not punishment, make society safer. We demand that harm reduction include everyone impacted by drug policies, users, growers, and sellers, and families. Artificial distinction between deserving and undeserving undermines our movement. Donors and governments must divest from the drug war and invest in health, justice, and community care. Redirect policing budgets to community-led harm reduction and economic alternatives. Fund models must be prioritized, flexible, co-long-term support for grassroots organizations. Programs like Robert Carr Fund and Love Alliance have been vital, and their continuity is critical. Center the leadership from the Global South, follow resource and amplify the expertise of the people with lived experience working in formal settlements and marginalized communities. Let's make decision and funding flow to those who deliver results on the ground. We want to leave Vienna with a clear vision that we should divest from drug war and invest in health, justice, and community, and commit to nothing for us about us. When people who use drugs lead, harm reduction become radical, loving, and transformative force. Thank you, Chair.
That was a representative of the Africa Network of People Who Use Drugs addressing delegates on the morning of Thursday, March 12th at the 69th session of the UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs. Here's Judy Chang, Program Officer at the Open Society Foundations.
Thank you. Chair, distinguished delegates, colleagues, I speak on behalf of the Open Society Institute. Across the world, blunt and myopic efforts to counter the world drug problem continue to entrench rather than remedy gender inequality. Women, transgender, and gender diverse communities are punished not because they are dangerous, but because systems of drug control criminalize poverty, marginalization, and survival. These are political choices, not inevitabilities. Our work across regions shows that where punitive drug laws dominate, gender injustice grows. Women and gender diverse people who use drugs are pushed away from healthcare through fear of arrest, surveillance, and the threat of losing their children. Measures framed as protection too often function as mechanisms of control. Gendered injustice also begins long before consumption. Women cultivating coca, opium poppy, or cannabis are frequently landless, excluded from markets, and left without viable alternatives. Forced eradication destroys their livelihoods, deepens poverty, militarizes communities, and exposes them to violence. Calling this development is politically convenient but fundamentally incorrect. It is displacement, not development. Alternative development initiatives that exclude women or ignore structural inequalities simply reproduce the same harms under a new label. Effective ethical development must guarantee women's land rights, income, safety, and leadership. Likewise, the rapid rise in women's incarceration for drug offences, the fastest growing prison population globally, is the predictable result of policies that equate punishment with public safety. Punitive drug control is incompatible with gender equality. Interagency cooperation and coordination of efforts aligned with multilateral norms and carried through a broad array of agencies is needed in order to progress the path towards rights, gender justice, and peace. The path is already mapped from the Human Rights Council Resolution 6026, the 2019 Ministerial Declaration, the 2016 UNGAS Outcome Document, the UN Common Position on Drugs, which are all accompanied by critical normative and technical guidance from UNAIDS, WHO, OHCHR, UN Women and UNDP. Interagency cooperation requires sharing in power in ways that accord with relevant expertise and prioritise people's needs over political gain. We encourage Member States to adopt bold, rights-based, gender-just drug policies, decriminalisation, community-led gender-responsive harm reduction, protection of parental rights, gender-specific services, programs and measures, equitable alternative development, meaningful participation, and accountability through gender disaggregated data. When governments choose evidence over ideology and rights and democratic participation over punishment, supported by UN entities, communities become safer and women's autonomy strengthens societies. Thank you.
That was Judy Chang, Program Officer at the Open Society Foundations, addressing the CND's 69th session on Thursday, March 12th. We'll have more from the CND next week, including some really powerful presentations from a few of the side events. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port Service. Public media needs your support now more than ever, so please support public media and local community radio. Become members. Become volunteers. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.